Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 743, Interview with Russ Baker. This is being recorded on Friday, May 27th of the year 2011, the Friday of Memorial Day weekend. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Russ Baker, the author of the consummately important Family of Secrets and the editor-in-chief of the Who, What, Why website. Russ, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thanks, Dave. It's always a pleasure to be here. Very stimulating experience, and I'm never disappointed.
All righty. Well, let's hope that I live up to that remarkable billing. We've spoken about Family of Secrets many times in the past, and 7 hours worth, and I think it is indicative of the weightiness and the meatiness of the book that we've scratched the surface, but no more than that. We have not spoken that much about the website, the Who, What, Why website, and one of the articles on your website, and I think something that might provide us with an element of transition from the past to the present, because I really don't think in terms of political analysis one can separate those. But that is your article about what Obama is up against, for one, and also your recent article about the history of the petroleum industry and the national security establishment, this in the wake of yet another unsuccessful attempt at removing the tax breaks from big oil. In terms of Well, let's start with Obama's presidency. A lot of people have been very disappointed in what he has done or what he hasn't done in many cases. A person who was one of my role models is the political comedian Mort Saul, who, as a lot of people know, was one of Jim Garrison's investigators. And in his autobiography, Heartland, in 1976, Mort Saul asked the question, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? And then he asked, is it too late for America? And I think that might be an interesting point of departure for an analysis of Obama and the petroleum industry and what he has and has not been able to do. What is Barack Obama up against in your opinion? How would you synopsize that article? And if I could, the links between your massive book and what is going on today, I think, might provide a frame of reference for the audience.
Well, Dave, as you know, my book, Family of Secrets, and the subtitle is The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. I think that last part of Family of Secrets subtitle, The Hidden History of the Last 50 Years, is maybe what we ought to key in on. Mm-hmm. And that is about the gulf between what we are told and what has actually been going on. And I certainly can't claim to know entirely what was going on. But in the 5 years that I spent researching Family of Secrets, I began pushing on some doors that I hadn't pushed on before, discovering some new rabbit holes, if you will, and beginning to see in case after case after case that there was the story that we'd been told both by the establishment media and also by academia to a large extent. And then there was a very different reality on the ground. And this was almost traumatic for me because as a longtime journalist, I have liked to believe that I had a good grasp on things. And when I realized how little I had a grasp on, even after years of doing investigative work, I really said, wow, there's a whole different ballgame here. So when we look at Barack Obama, I think he needs to be seen in the context of what shaped, affected, and happened to the prior occupants of the White House. Now, Family of Secrets, which is nominally an investigative history of the Bush family, is really about all presidents. And we have sections on John F. Kennedy, Richard Nixon, Jimmy Carter, and other presidents. And I really began looking at how all presidents get to the top and then why they do what they do when they're there. Now,
and also Gerald Ford, we should add.
Gerald Ford and others. Mm-hmm. But Lyndon Johnson to some extent. Now, what I'm talking about here is that we have a kind of a pageant with the presidency. It's easier for us to sort of pay attention to things if they could all sort of be seen kind of in the entertainment arena. And so these are opportunities to sort of have favorites and to bet and to watch hopefuls come up and then crash and surprise horses coming from behind and what have you. And so that kind of narrative is the one that we tend to like as people. And it's the one that the media gladly serves up time and again. And it also part of that is the sort of the president character is this kind of singular figure strutting upon the stage of history, riding in, galloping in, and so forth, hung on their own petard and so on. But the reality is quite different, and that is that power plays long. And power is about interests, and interests don't go away, and they certainly don't go away willingly. And we don't cover interests very well, and it's almost like they don't exist. It's kind of like, for example, now who will be the Republican nominee is the current game, although, in fact, whoever it is going to have to be somebody who is acceptable to certain sectors that, as I say, are not discussed. And so when you look at Barack Obama, you have to understand that he could never have gotten to the top unless he was deemed acceptable enough to these sectors, and that his range of movement as president is constricted by these same interests.
I'd like to just briefly jump in. One of the things that was remarkable about Obama was the rise. I think it's a safe bet that in 2000, almost nobody had heard of him in America. And then by 2004, he was the next big thing on the horizon. And by 2008 primaries, he was a walk. So it's all pay for play in this society now. And you don't get that far without some very powerful interests behind him. So, yes, go ahead. Absolutely.
We don't examine someone like Barack Obama much better than we do someone on American Idol. The person just comes up and there they are in the spotlight. And that's inadequate. And so what I tried to do with Family of Secrets and what we do with our ongoing news and analysis website, whowhatwhy.com, is to examine all of these people, while they're in power, while they're on their way to power, while they're trying to get power, to understand not just who they are, but more importantly, who they're shaped by. Because you know, people always say, well, you and I could never be president, but then why would that be? I mean, if anyone can grow up to be president, then anyone should be able to be president, but in fact, they can't be. And so in the case of Obama, there are a lot of interesting things one could look at about him that I think would be indicators of the limited range of movement to which he would be inclined. But even assuming that he would like to do more, we have this back history of what happened to presidents who did try to do more. And in Family of Secrets, I focus particularly on two people you would think who are so-called nemeses and who you would think would be polar opposites in every respect, John F. Kennedy and Richard M. Nixon. And yet what you see when you really study what happened to them was that both men, once they obtained the presidency, began stretching their wings and began trying to do things that the presidency supposedly allows an individual to do. And they both discovered that, no, you may not do those things if those things are unacceptable to certain sectors. Now, people may be wondering, what do I mean by these sectors? I'm talking about things that we know exist. These are not phantasms. These are the oil industry, the most powerful industry the Earth has ever known. Just given that, that ought to be covered every day very aggressively, and yet it's not covered really at all. And the other one is the one that all the way back 50 years ago, Dwight Eisenhower warned us about, the so-called military-industrial complex, which actually now might well be called the military-industrial espionage, financial, academic, add whatever other words you want to that, a complex. And this is, again, not a figment of our imagination, but one of the most powerful constructs that has ever existed on Earth. Nobody would deny that it is there, and yet, again, we don't cover it and we don't talk about it. So these are, I think, the power centers, the constituencies that ultimately matter the most to a president, to whether they're going to get in, to whether they're going to stay in, and to what they do when they're in power.
Another interesting article, and we can talk about the oil industry in more specific terms in a couple of minutes, but there was an article that, I can't recall the exact title. It had a very eye-catching and not altogether attractive picture of Barack Obama in front of Air Force One, but with a Donald Trump hairstyle graphicked in. And the article is called "Trump is Not the Carnival Sideshow. The political, quote, normal, unquote, is." One of my favorite quotes, and I'm going to ask you to sort of take off on that article from this quote. One of my favorite quotes comes from author Edith Wharton, who said, "A frivolous society can only achieve dramatic significance through what its frivolity destroys," which I think is just a great quote, and it's a deep one. But in a way, I think that's if I understood what Ms. Wharton was talking about, it's what you're talking about in that article. You know, behind the carnival sideshow, I mean, Trump is the north end of a southbound horse, but he's also a very potent political animal, too, and he's not really very funny. And yet, you know, we see this reality TV show nonsense, and it looks ludicrous. I think it also tends to turn people off on politics and debase the whole frame of debate. But the phenomenon of Trump the candidate, Trump the reality talk show host, distracts us from just how ludicrous our political intellectual culture is.
Well, right. And what I'm getting at is that if you looked with any degree of objectivity at the problems facing the United States and the world today, which are so incredibly grave, and then you see the scope and the pace of the action with regard to those problems, you have to say that the central show itself, forget about the Trumps and the Palins and what have you, the central show itself is ludicrous on its face. And I feel that the Trumps and what have you play a very crucial role. First of all, Trump is a very serious businessman in the sense that he markets himself as a brander, that he will come into somebody's building, an ordinary building they're putting up. He will put his name and his face on there, and they will be able to jack up the rates for the place because a certain sector of the populace will then want to have that brand on their apartment. And that's really what he is. And so for him, any kind of television show, no matter what it is that gets ratings, any kind of thing like running for president is good for his brand. He needs that. Just as movie stars, we think that their lives are so tumultuous, but there a lot of that is invented because it keeps them in the public eye, and that is the where we get the marquee names, and that's what draws us to go see their movies. So that's how the system works. Now, the central act itself then is given this, is sort of invested with this sort of gravitas that it doesn't deserve. And then we don't look at things like, okay, so Obama clearly much more serious than these other candidates. And yet right now the United States is involved in, well, I'd say at least three wars, possibly more depending on how you count them. Maybe Pakistan, a fourth one, and I'm counting Libya as well. Mm-hmm. And so what are those wars about? And if we stop to say, well, now, please explain why we are in those wars. Now, that would seem to be a central question, something that ought to be being discussed on a daily basis, and yet it's not. You've got someone like a Denis Kucinich who's out there looking like he's some kind of a nut for sort of raising these types of questions, very much an outcast. And so they're able to kind of skew the whole thing and keep people away from talking about what really matters, which is that there's a central activities of our government, the central uses of our tax dollars are not understood to us and don't make any sense. And so these sideshows are crucial because you and I, outside of our work and outside of our families and our most urgent personal concerns, we only have a little bit of bandwidth left. And if they can fill that bandwidth up with Dancing with the Stars and Sarah Palin's daughter's scandals and what we think of Donald Trump's hairdo and so forth, they've filled that up. There is nothing left for us to worry about the state of our democracy.
One of the things that I find really vexatious and yet it also is the raison d'etre for my program. It's underground and always has been and always will be. But that is basically our media do not do their job, and neither does our educational system. I would encapsulate that by basically saying that both are at the purse strings level controlled by the same powerful corporate interests that affect many of these machinations. But the media do not do their job. One of my favorite catchphrases on this program is that the fourth estate has metamorphosed into a fifth column. And they really are accessories to criminal behavior, accessories after the fact in most cases, because they will not tell the truth. The Gray Lady being an example of this. The New York Times is certainly well worth reading. I read it when I can. I've got an awful lot of reading to do on top of the day job. But at the same time, it's also the CIA's number one propaganda asset. They published the Warren Report, which is fiction. And when the chips are on the table, so to speak, with regard to intelligence matters, the New York Times can be counted upon to come down squarely on the side of reaction. The pillorying of Gary Webb being an example after he broke the CIA cocaine story. The New York Times published the Warren Report, which is nonsense. It's fiction. And they're quite good at doing this. And yet, compared with some papers, the New York Times is is in a class by itself. So our media don't do their job. We don't get the investigative reporting, and I've devoted this broadcast to trying to close that gap. And the 6 hours we did just about exactly a year ago with another follow-up interview last December being an example of that. Certainly, you're not going to get on the main talk shows. You're not going to get on Meet the Press. You're not even probably – has the New York Times touched your book?
They requested specifically an advance copy. One of their top reviewers requested an advance copy of my book, wanted to be the first person to review it. We did supply the book, and then nothing ever happened.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of how things go. Another of my favorite phrases is an old Turkish proverb, he who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages, or perhaps just doesn't get their book reviewed by the New York Times, which is a way of chasing you out of a lot of villages.
I think what happens here is it's more insidious than some sort of organized suppression. What you're looking at is all of us, if we are practical people, having a sense of what it takes to get a job, keep a job, perhaps advance. And we know pretty well, I don't care what you do for a living, you know pretty well what will fly with the bosses and what won't. And you know what will fly with the customers and what won't. And so you do your best to kind of stay within those bounds. So when you work at the New York Times or CBS or anything else, you may be a perfectly good person. You probably got into journalism because you cared and you wanted to make a difference. And you do. You make a difference as much as you can. But there's the key phrase, as much as you can. And so I am told privately all the time, gee, I'd love to, you know, this started when I was shopping the Family of Secrets manuscript through my agent that the various publishers literally said, boy, is that what a book that is. I only wish I had the blankety blanks to mm-hmm. publish it. Mm-hmm. They realized they were going to have some problems. And so every point we discuss, will this place be too afraid? Will this place be too afraid? And so this is not exclusive to Family of Secrets. Anything particularly explosive will not be heard. And what is heard that's explosive is scandal, but it's not new history. And so you might say, oh, well, we heard about Dominique Strauss-Kahn, you know, that's explosive. Well, it's a personal scandal of a famous person, and that they will do. But if you actually think about what you've been told over the years on programs, perhaps in school, high school or university, in your classes and so on, there has never been a total break with the past, no revelation as there is in every other field in medicine and in physics and so on, where they say, wow, we've got a whole new understanding of things here. And then, you know, there's in those fields, by the way, of course, there's tremendous resistance from the establishment always. But eventually something new comes through. Usually the people with the new theory or the new whatever are ridiculed or ignored or attacked. But eventually they prevail. And, of course, we see this in art. We see this in everything. It's particularly consequential, of course, with our understanding of how our world works in terms of decisions affecting life and death, freedom, the health and goodwill of the public and so forth. And so the inability to get a narrative like Family of Secrets or other books like it. My book has 50 pages of footnotes. We went to great lengths to make it credible and palatable to the establishment. It has it's from a well-respected mainstream publisher. It has blurbs on the cover from beloved, extremely well-known figures. And we had to do all that, and that helped a little bit. But even with that, we've been told time and again, what you reveal in this book is so disturbing and so contrary to what we understood and what we've been saying all this time. We simply don't know how to deal with that.
The Moritz Saul quote from his, you know, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? Again, it also reminds me of the famous Upton Sinclair quote, it's difficult to get a man or a person, updating it to a non-gender specific context, it's difficult to get a person to understand something when keeping their job depends on their not understanding it. And I think that is certainly one of the things that's bedeviled Family of Secrets. Nonetheless, though, I think you've done a remarkable job. I never expected to see a lot of that stuff coming out in a mainstream book. I mean, I was aware of it. I've covered quite a bit of that in various broadcasts over 3+ decades, but I never expected to see it in a mainstream book, and I sure never expected to see, you know, Dan Rather, Bill Moyers, Gore Vidal endorsing that. It was a stunning thing, and it's a great achievement. I think the frontiers of investigative reporting in this country have been pushed back by that, and I think it's going to enable others to take more forward steps than they otherwise would have been able to do, although you may not see all of the fruit of that being born in your lifetime.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned investigative reporting. I belong to various associations of investigative reporters, and they're good people, and they're trying to do a good job. But I've noticed and been discussing this with some colleagues how when you look at, say, the awards that are given out and so forth, they're sort of astonishing by almost their pettiness in a way that they seem to look for and reward people who set their sights pretty low. And I'm not saying this is bad journalism. It's good journalism, but they it's very limited. And so stories about one-offs, you know, a town where the city council was corrupt, a particular agency where one thing really went bad. And what they seem to be saying almost by exclusion is that you know, we don't want to draw attention to anything that's systemic. We don't want to draw attention to anything that really questions the basic values that we say that we espouse. And I find, as I travel around the world and talking to people in other countries, they have a much better grasp almost anywhere, but in this country, of how power really works. And from Turkey, where they coined the concept of the deep state, to Mexico, which sees now a situation of almost total chaos there, up to Scandinavia, where I was last summer, places like Finland and so on, where they talk to me even there, countries that are very high on the integrity and transparency scales, rated way above the United States, and they say that even in their countries, they don't really, what is discussed publicly is not what goes on behind the scenes, that there are a handful of families and companies and so on that exert enormous amounts of influence sub rosa, shaping the events for everyone else.
The late Stieg Larsson's novels, which became hit movies and books in this country last year. Christopher Hitchens had a piece in Vanity Fair in which he quoted a Swedish police and intelligence official as saying the things Stieg Larsson wrote about actually occurred, it's just that he gave them fictional names. And that is part of, and Sweden certainly is a very civilized society, but that is an example of that. But here in America, we really are, in many ways, are like this is like a society of adolescents. America is like a giant high school with a multi-trillion-dollar budget in nuclear weapons, which sounds ludicrous, but the enormous unchecked corporate power that exists here, and with corresponding national security power, basically is, at least to what I can tell, irresistible. It is certainly dominant with a capital D.
Yeah, I mean, what they've got now is a system rigged to the point where and when I use the term they, people always say, well, who do you mean by they? But they is whatever, fill in that corporate name you want to fill in, have things rigged to the point where all of these different elements or institutions that were supposed to check each other they're all neutralized now. You were talking about the Fourth Estate, so the media is neutralized. The clergy in this country overwhelmingly, it's certainly not what it was at one point. You had a much more vibrant liberation theology out there. Obviously, the Congress is seriously compromised, very, very weak and timid compared, let's say, to the mid-1970s. The judiciary has moved so far away from what seemed at one point almost like it actually did have people on there who would sit and hear a case with a kind of an open mind and try to figure out, was there some way to derive a just and appropriate solution, to where we really suspect all of the people on there from right to left of having an agenda and some constituency that they're serving. So, you know, and then, of course, the executive branch. And so this is a serious, serious problem. And, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes people say to me, well, I read Family of Secrets. It really traumatized me. It changed my understanding of so many things, or it thrilled me because to see a whole different get a whole different understanding and have things sort of fall into place, things I'd been thinking about and wondering for years. But some people come up and they say, "Gee, you know, ultimately though, it's sort of immobilizing and depressing. And what can we do?" And I would argue that it's not our job to make sure that people aren't depressed. That it's not our job to worry that, you know, to give you more good news or happy talk, although on our website, Who, What, Why, we are putting a few funny things and a few good news things just to acknowledge the human need for that. But you can go elsewhere for that. There are flowers and puppies everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But that we need to get past that what you call that high school thing, that need to guard our own fragile emotions. We're much tougher when we need to be. And this is a time when we need to be tougher. And we need to sort of sit up straight, and we need to see, you know, maybe we need the proverbial bucket of cold water in our face, and to say, wow, so this is how things really work. Because then what we can do is we can, once we have a grasp of things, we can begin thinking about what do you do with that situation.
Let's talk about that more on side two. We're almost out of time on side one. Tell them about the website.
Our website is whowhatwhy.com. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. So if I may say so, if you like what we do, you can be part of the family. We can't do this. We can't hire and train more reporters and add content without public support. You can go to the site right at the top there. There's a right-hand corner, something you can click and support us on a one-time or on a monthly basis.
All righty. And the 7 previous interviews, including 6 specifically on Family of Secrets that I did roughly a year ago, are available at spitfirelist.com in the For the Record section. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 743, Interview with Russ Baker. This program is being recorded on May 27th of the year 2011. For Russ Baker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.